This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. In 1992, the Union of Concerned Scientists, a U.S.-based science advocacy organization, along with a group of 1,700 independent scientists, issued the World Scientists' Warning to Humanity. The scientists' declaration cautioned that humankind was on what it called a collision course with the natural world and was inflicting severe and perhaps even permanent damage to our planet. The statement went on to warn that unless people became more responsible guardians, the living world will become unable to sustain life in the manner we are accustomed to. The warning outlined a number of environmental factors they say would lead to such calamity. Recently, 25 years after this warning was issued, another group of more than 15,000 scientists reviewed the issues raised in the 1992 document and have issued an alarming follow-up to what they call the World Scientists' Warning to Humanity, Second Notice. The new report says that, except for one issue, humankind not only has pretty much failed to make adequate progress in solving the environmental conditions outlined in 1992, but that most of them are getting far worse. The report also asserts that a mass extinction event, the sixth in about 540 million years, has been unleashed and many of Earth's current life forms could be destroyed or at least committed to extinction by the end of this century. Today, my guests and I will discuss various aspects of the World Scientists' Warning to Humanity, Second Notice. My first guest today is Peter Fromhoff, the Director of Science and Policy and the Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, the World Scientists' Warning to Humanity, a Second Notice, was released recently to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the original Warning to Humanity. Now, how does this new edition of the warning differ from the one released in 1992?
So 25 years ago, as you mentioned, the Union of Concerned Scientists, an organization that I'm proud to be working at and a part of, released a warning that was signed by the majority of the then-living Nobel laureates in the sciences and many other leading scientists that was really a wake-up call that tied together the range of changes in the environment that were then being understood in the scientific community, but not necessarily well understood in the mind of the public and among policymakers, everything from climate change to the loss of biological diversity to the decline in the ozone hole, and laid out a kind of action call for citizens, for business leaders, for the public, and for governments to do their work, to engage in responding to the challenges that the scientists were highlighting with policies, with actions that were based on the best available science. And we've seen a lot of good changes since then, but problems persist. So this call, which, to be clear, the Union of Concerned Scientists did not organize, came from an independent group of scientists led by colleagues at Oregon State University, is an attempt to update, to show the trends that we've seen since 1992, and to point out quite accurately that while we've had some really important successes, some of the really alarming trends that were highlighted in 1992 still persist today. And so it's a reminder of the urgency of action, of the need for policies to be based on science. And it's a reflection of the fact that the scientific community continues to be quite alarmed at the pace of global environmental change and the need for us to alter our course.
What stood out for me in reading over the second notice here is this statement: "Moreover, we have unleashed a mass extinction event, the sixth in roughly 540 million years, wherein many current life forms could be annihilated or at least committed to extinction by the end of this century." That's pretty alarming. Can you explain?
Yes, it is deeply alarming. The loss of biological diversity is one of the great challenges of our time. It's a consequence of pace at which forests have been cleared to agricultural land, at the rate at which oceans have been harvested for fish, at the changes in climate that are altering the habitats in which we are all living, and many, many species in rainforests, in mountaintops across the planet live in very bounded climatic zones. And as the climate changes, their abilities to persist with those changes are quite limited. If you're living at the top of a mountain, there's no place to go. If you're living in a rainforest and the climate becomes drier, again, there's no place to go. And so the pace of environmental change and the human impact on our planet globally is in fact driving species extinction. And the estimates are that over the course of this century, as the updated warning correctly highlights, we will see a rate of extinction that is essentially the sixth great extinction that this planet has seen, but in a very, very short period of time. Previous extinctions took place over millennia.
Now, the new warning, the second warning to humanity, is reflecting off the 1992 original version. Does the new version predict what could happen in the future, or is it merely a comparison of then and now, as far as conditions are concerned?
Yeah, its primary focus is to look at the continuation of trends that we've seen, of the rates of increase in carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere and temperature rise that results from it, of population growth, of changes that we've seen over the past 25 years that build on trends before. I want to highlight, though, those trends are not all grim news, and there are really important changes that we've seen. For example, the ozone depletion that was highlighted in the 92 statement has been dramatically reversed because we globally set policies to eliminate the use of chlorofluorocarbons, which were driving the decline in the ozone layer. And as a consequence, that global trend has ultimately reversed. We've seen a transition towards a restoring ozone hole. And that reminds us that, just as with the stock market, history is no indicator or determinant of future change. It's really up to us. And we can make changes based on good science. And we have an opportunity to do so with many of these other trends as well. Let me turn, if I can, to the issue of forests, an interesting and important measure. Forests have declined in many parts of the world and continue to. And of course, deforestation is one of the central drivers of loss of access to fresh water, because forests are become important watersheds, the places where water is purified and filtered, and also their habitats for many, many, many species. And therefore, deforestation is a driver of species extinction. But again, sometimes global trends mask important news that happened at smaller but still very large scales. So, for example, much of the world's biological diversity is in the rainforests, and the Brazilian Amazon is, as we all know, a centerpiece of diversity. The Amazon has experienced rapid deforestation rates, much like rainforests throughout the planet. But since about 2005, deforestation rates in the Brazilian Amazon have dropped precipitously. Dropped by about two-thirds. Amazonian forests are still being deforested, but rates have declined dramatically over the past decade or so, and that's a consequence of public awareness, of public policies, of changing consumer habits. People are no longer sometimes choosing to boycott or not to buy foods that are harvested from areas cleared in rainforests. So there's all manner of changes that are happening both in Brazil and globally that have led to dramatic changes in the rates of deforestation in a place of great importance globally, as well as, of course, for Brazil. And that's an example of a trend that might not show up in a global synopsis, as in the recent warning, but is nonetheless an indicator of what's possible and can be amplified by following good science and good policies, not just in Brazil, but in other parts of the world. If people choose to not buy palm oil, for example, that is coming from areas that have been recently cleared by forests, all manner of changes that can happen. And so I want to make sure that as we highlight the often quite grim global trends, that we're also recognizing that within them are kind of bright lights of possible transitions, examples to follow, cases to learn from, and that's one of them.
Okay, what about the big one, climate change?
Yeah, well, it is the big one. And of course, deforestation, I was just alluding to it, is one of the biggest drivers of increasing greenhouse gas emissions when forests are cleared. So the Brazil news is another good example of how we can see positive change. But globally, I was just at the International Climate Negotiations in Germany, where it was announced that global carbon dioxide emissions have increased about 2% over the course of the last year. And that's part of a global trend of increasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere that have continued and in many cases worsened since 1992. And that's a terribly somber statistic. The climate is changing. Humans are responsible, not just deforestation, but primarily from the burning of fossil fuels. And we've seen significant progress on the part of most nations to recognize the problem, to come to agreements about commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We're just at the front end of that. As you may know, in 2015, nations came together in Paris to voluntarily, most of them, lay out their commitments to reduce emissions. And we're seeing tremendous positive growth in clean energy, in wind, in solar, in other forms of energy that doesn't require fossil fuel, but doesn't lead to increase in greenhouse gas emissions. But we have a good ways to go. The changes we're seeing already in our climate, we're about 1 degree Celsius or about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. We're already seeing intensifying storms and increasing heat waves. And of course, many of us saw and experienced the hurricanes that hit the U.S. over the course of the last year. The last 3 years have been the hottest years on record. And there's no sign of that trend abating anytime soon. So the climate is changing. Humans are responsible. We can do something about it by reducing our emissions. And, you know, the scientific community is committed to helping make sure that policies are based on the best available science. Unfortunately, not every national government, and including and particularly prominently at the moment the United States, some governments, the U.S. in particular, have backed away from commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that's a very disturbing sign.
Do you think there may be a need for a third or further subsequent warnings to humanity after this one was issued?
You know, I think the important thing is that we track these changes, that we understand them, that we are resolved to address them. I'd like to imagine that 25 years from now, when we come back and look backwards, that we see that not just the ozone hole is the good news story, but that these other trends are heading in the right direction as well, that greenhouse gas emissions are heading towards zero, which they need to be this century if we're going to avert the worst consequences of climate change, that fresh water is more available, not less available, that population trends are stabilizing through investments in women's and girls' education and economic empowerment and access to contraception. The things we know how to do are actually being done. I mean, these problems are not inherent. That's really important. We know how to solve each of them. It's really not technically difficult, but it is essential that we invest in solutions in ways that are consistent with and based on the science to reverse these trends and to bring about a sustainability transition that is not just about the ozone hole, but is about each of the major drivers of global change that threaten us all. And I don't want to be Pollyannish or unduly optimistic, but we know we can do this. We've seen it happen both globally on some trends and regionally on others. And it's really a matter of political will and commitment and common sense to help ensure that our kids and grandkids have a healthy, biologically diverse, safe and sustainable planet on which to inherit.
Peter Frumhoff, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Peter Frumhoff, the Director of Science and Policy and the Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. We also would like you to connect with us by email at encounter@voanews.com or check out our Facebook page at Carol Castiel VOA. Today, we're talking about the world scientists' warning to humanity, Second Notice, a declaration that was recently issued by more than 15,000 scientists from around the world. The scientists' warning asserts that unless we make efforts to stem a number of outstanding environmental issues, the living world will become unable to sustain life in the manner we're accustomed to. My guest for the next segment of our program is Earl Ellis, an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Professor Ellis says that he agrees that all the trends identified in the second scientific warning paper and that they raise serious concerns. He says that his primary disagreement with the paper is the way it presents its case. Earl, how does the paper present its case?
It presents the case from the point of view of the scientists are, in a sense, just trying to gauge concern. We're just trying to create concern. And I don't think that's enough. And I think that focusing on the concern element doesn't focus on the solutions-oriented narratives that scientists need to start focusing on. We can't get by with just warning people.
Dr. Ellis, have you read both the original and second warning to humanity reports, the first one issued back in 1992 and this one recently?
Excellent question. I probably have read it, but I did not reread it recently. So I've only read the recent piece.
So what did you take away from reading the recent second warning to humanity?
Very simply, that we still have a lot of the environmental challenges that we had in the 1990s that we haven't done enough And I think that's accurate. I think that's an accurate fact. Now, the types of indicators that are presented and the narrative about warning rather than a narrative about what we've succeeded in and what we still need to do, I think would have presented a much more compelling case to the public than simply a warning. In a sense, the solutions are buried in the text rather than made explicit as the reason for the scientists trying to engage the public.
The report has been painted, as you mentioned, by some as being gloom and doom. And I'm wondering, wouldn't it be more effective to have kind of a scary report to help motivate people to reach climate change and other environmental goals?
Yes, and I would characterize the report to some degree as gloom and doom. And, well, I think we have the experience since the 1990s message to show us that it does engage a certain part of the public. There are people who focus on the environmental challenges that we need to overcome through a crisis narrative. I would argue that that's no more than about a quarter of at least the United States population. For them, this is a message that really resonates. And it certainly resonates with the media where, you know, any kind of crisis narrative is going to be much more exciting and gain much more, many more eyeballs than something saying, we have got some challenges that we can overcome.
Reading the report, do you think the authors exaggerated any points in the report?
Good question. I think the one area where I was a bit concerned, and it's hard to say whether they're exaggerating or just misconstruing, but the issues about population growth, I think, are problematic, let me put it that way.
How so?
Well, so one trend, they actually added a trend, but the original trend in population growth is presented. So you see the total number of people on the planet is increasing, and that's no doubt true. That's absolutely true. And in fact, you could argue that the prediction of that population growth in the 1970s, it was predicted. There's nothing that should shock us about the fact that we now have 7 billion people, because in 1970, you could already predict this. And in fact, we can already predict that we're going to have at least 9, probably 10, maybe even 11 billion by the end of this century, regardless almost of any policy. It's very hard to change the trend of population growth with a very large population. That's item number one. But item number two, which is the most important of all, is they do not show the graph of changes in population growth rate. And that's the critical number there, is the rate of population growth. In other words, the number of people added per unit of people over time, is that number increasing or staying the same? In other words, are we accelerating our growth rate, or is it just basically we're carrying out some growth on an existing large population? And if you look at the chart of growth rate over time, you see an amazing decline. Growth rates have just tanked since the 1970s. And that is an amazing positive trend.
In reading that article again that was posted by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you were quoted as saying that you're somewhat embarrassed for your colleagues in the science community who signed on and backed the warning report. Is this true? And if so, why?
Very simple. As I said, right now, there's been a lot of research into effective environmental messaging in terms of outreach to the public. You know, what resonates with the public, not for eyeballs that let them look at an article, but that engage them in a process of social change. That's something that will stick with them over time. Remember, we're never going to solve these problems this year or next year. It's going to take decades to solve these problems. We need to engage people in a sustainable approach to the solution. To make that happen, crisis messaging isn't going to work. It hasn't worked since the 90s. It's engaged some people, but it hasn't engaged enough, right? We have a lot of infighting and contradictory understanding of the challenges ahead in the American population, for example. And a lot of this results from this kind of crisis messaging where scientists just serve to warn humanity. We're not here to help. We're just here to warn. And I think that's the kind of message we need. We are here to help. Scientists are here to help society determine its own better future. And it's not going to do this just because scientists tell them to. It's going to have to come from people, all of us, together, deciding to move forward on better strategies for the future. And that more positive view is currently actually embraced by a large number of different institutions and aspirational messages about the environment, not just talking about how to stop a disaster, but how to build a better future. That kind of messaging, which is also a very scientific thing, can also be part, and maybe a more important part, of the environmental messaging. Very easy to sign on to a big warning to humanity, but it's not as easy to sign on to a project that will improve the future. And that's what we need to be signing on to. And I can give some examples. Half Earth and the Nature Needs Half project. This is an idea that we can conserve half of the biosphere for biodiversity, for wild nature, and that this is an aspirational goal. This is something that is going to make the future better for humanity, and it's going to make the future better for all the rest of life on Earth. That's a very important message. It's an aspirational message. It's not just about the science. It's about what kind of future do we want. Another example is the Smithsonian Institution just held an Earth Optimism Summit. Okay, and why did they do this? Why did they hold a Summit for Earth Optimism instead of Warning Humanity Summit? It's because it's the basis for engaging people in a sustained project to make the future better, whether it's about climate change or preserving biodiversity or natural resources. This is the kind of messaging that brings people to the table, that brings people together to solve problems. Conservation Optimism is a project of the Interdisciplinary Center for Conservation Science at Oxford. This is a project that is dedicated to inspiring people to engage in conservation and make a positive difference for nature, rather than basically frightening people with a doom and gloom message. And even the Seeds of a Good Anthropocene project of Future Earth that's currently looking at what kinds of prospects do we see now for developing a better future. I would admit this, and maybe I shouldn't, but I will. I will admit that based on the evidence I see, I'm not convinced we're going to be able to hold climate change, anthropogenic, human-caused climate change, to less than 2 degrees. We're probably heading to 2 degrees just via how slow societies are acting to stem that tide. And that should be concern all of us, because a 2-degree planet is going to be a worse planet. We're going to have a lot of things in a 2-degree hotter planet that we're not going to, that are not going to be good for us, and they're not going to be good for the rest of nature. But it's still not the end of the world. It's much better to have a 2-degree than a 2.5-degree planet or a 3-degree planet. And we need to be focusing on what we can do to make the future better, not this idea that if we get to some point, there'll be no planet left or something like that. There's going to be a planet. The question is it going to be better or worse? And we need to focus on making it better.
You say that the report emphasizes the negatives and doesn't really get into the progress that has been made to address these issues. You brought a little bit of these up. What other kind of progress do you see being made in addressing some of the hard issues brought up by the second warning to humanity?
I should say that the article does bring some of these things up. It doesn't totally leave them out. It just narrows them to a very tiny part, one paragraph of the paper, more or less. Rather than calling them out as really, in some ways, the most important message. We can solve these problems. We can make a difference. And some of the examples that are raised right in the article are the fact that we did stave off the loss of the ozone layer. We were rapidly destroying the ozone layer with CFCs. This is something that was going on in the 1970s. And by the 90s, even, we had already started the trend of fixing this. And now, arguably, we've stemmed that tide. We still have a few risks from some other chemicals, but compared to before, we've more or less saved the ozone layer. So that's an example of scientists working together with society. It wasn't done just by scientists. It had a lot to do with the political negotiations that enabled that, the Montreal Protocol, to basically turning the tide against destroying the ozone layer. So that's just one example of many. One that I think was very central around is the message from the 70s that there was going to be essentially a giant population crash happening as a result of overpopulation and basically being unable to feed that population. And none of that happened for the simple reason that the use of more productive technologies in agriculture has increased productivity on mostly on the same land. We've definitely cleared some more land, but not nearly as much as we would have had if the yields or productivity of agriculture had stayed the same. The productivity of agriculture per acre has gone up in a really amazing way. It's not going up as fast as it should be now or as fast as it needs to. But in general, right, there's more food now on the planet per person than there was in the past.
Dr. Earl Ellis, I want to thank you so much for taking time to sit down and talk with us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That was Earl Ellis, an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank both of my guests for joining me today, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen today. Encounter was produced at the VOA Studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.